You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the average of new COVID-19 cases is trending downward nationwide, but ticking up again here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to an epidemiologist about the trends and the latest news on vaccines and booster shots. Now, more than 11 months since the end of the 2020 general election, a former Wisconsin State Supreme Court justice is still working on a report looking at what happened in that election. Michael Gabelman was appointed to conduct the investigation by Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and given a deadline of the end of this month. This week, subpoenas came out, then got pulled back again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this ongoing investigation of the election that's almost a year out at this point? Would you like to know more about what happened? Do you think we know what we need to know at this point? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
A lot of twists and turns to get through this week, Laurel. Can you start us off with the basics, though, about the goals of this investigation being led by the former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman?
So kind of the top line goals that Gabelman has outlined for this investigation is to, one, establish how Wisconsin elections should be run, how they were run in 2020, and any recommendations after his evaluation that he sees fit for changes to Wisconsin elections. Now, it's really important to note that, you know, from the outset, Gabelman has, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who tapped Gabelman to lead this, have had the perspective that things may have gone wrong in the election. You know, I think the word that Voss used when he introduced Gabelman for the first time as the head of this was shenanigans. So we know that, you know, as well, Gabelman went to the pretty controversial Arizona election inquiry this summer. He went to an event hosted by MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell. Lindell, of course, has advanced a lot of debunked theories about the election, false claims about the election. So that's part of the conversation of what Gabelman is bringing into this. But as I said before, you know, his stated goals are to outline what should happen, what did happen, and any changes that need to be made.
Okay, here comes subpoenas issued to a bunch of cities for city clerks in five cities, then the mayors of those communities, and then they're gone. What happened?
So it's pretty complicated. Gabelman said last month that subpoenas might be coming for communities that didn't release the records that he thought he needed to conduct the investigation. We saw the first round of subpoenas were for election officials, local election officials. Those came out last week. And then, as you said, we've gotten some this week for the mayors of Wisconsin's five largest cities: Milwaukee, Madison, Racine, Kenosha, and Green Bay. And it's been kind of a bumpy ride. These were issued on Wednesday, and I've been in touch with several representatives of these communities today, and there are ongoing conversations about kind of scaling back what the subpoenas asked for. Because what they did ask for was very, very broad. Essentially, they were asking mayors and all those communities to release all of the documents that they have related to the 2020 election. And the mayor of Madison described this as, potentially, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages of documents, just a huge request here. So in light of some of that pushback, there are ongoing conversations now about, you know, scaling that back and what that's going to look like.
And the subpoenas now, they're saying, Gabelman is saying, no, I don't need to meet with you as of now. We only want documents already released to other public records requests. Pretty scaled back from the initial subpoena request.
It is pretty scaled back. And from what I've been able to report today, Rob, it sounds like it's varying a bit from community to community. What you described about, you know, just getting the public records that had previously been released about the election is definitely what's happening in Madison, according to the city attorney there. They said that basically what they're going to do is hand over, and what's been agreed upon is hand over every document that's related to a public records request about the election that's come in since last November. and now. He said that's probably between 20 and 25 individual record requests that are all pretty different, wide ranging. I heard from Milwaukee, they weren't as specific. They said there are ongoing conversations about limiting what they're going to give, but didn't say anything about that limitation maybe being related to public records requests. I heard from Kenosha that they hadn't had any, at least the representative that I have been in contact with about the subpoenas in the past, hadn't heard anything about changes going on there quite yet. So this does seem to be a pretty fluid conversation about, you know, what these document releases are going to look like. And then, as you said, there are interviews that are part of this too. And in Madison, the interview has been postponed until they look at those public record documents and decide, the investigators decide what they want to, you know, talk about.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about the investigation of Wisconsin's elections from last year, led by a former Supreme Court justice in the state. Laurel, good thing I follow along at WPR.org. I see a new piece you have up on another aspect of this. A judge says information about this investigation has to be made public after a lawsuit. What's going on there?
Yeah, so that's very fresh news just in the last few minutes. A Dane County judge has ordered Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who spearheaded this investigation, to release some records about the investigation that a number of groups have been seeking for a while now. The group that filed this lawsuit is called American Oversight. The Dane County judge ruled in their favor and said that Voss has been inappropriately withholding the documents that they want to see about the investigation, and that he needs to immediately release them. If he doesn't agree to do so, he is ordered under the judge's action today to appear in court in early November. So Voss could appeal this. We don't have a comment from his office quite yet. But this is obviously a pretty big development that could, if the records are released, give us some more insight into kind of the behind the scenes workings of how this investigation is structured.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chuck is with us in Fort Atkinson. Chuck, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
I think the investigation where all of a sudden they're stopping the subpoenas and the interviews just indicates that they really don't know what they are going after. They don't really have a plan. It was hastily put together, specifically when Assembly Leader Voss was spanked by Donald Trump, saying you should look into this. All of a sudden, there's an investigation. So I don't think that they're going to find anything that they're looking for, even though they thinly veil it as this is, we want to make sure elections are good and we want to change things that are bad, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a thin veil for doing another fruitless investigation costing a lot of money.
Chuck, thanks for the call. We may not know all the answers to what Chuck was saying until we see some of those documents we were just talking about, if that judge's ruling is upheld. But has that been some of the criticism, Laurel, the response to this investigation, especially from Democrats?
Absolutely. And that's been some of the recent pushback on the subpoenas. Just, you know, some folks have said that the breadth and depth of the request of mayors to release all documents that they have pertaining to the election shows that it's the investigation is unfocused. It doesn't know what it's looking for. It doesn't have particular concerns. There aren't things that, you know, it has evidence about that it's looking into specifically, for example. So that's certainly part of the ongoing conversation and the criticism, is that this investigation doesn't have an aim, that it's kind of amorphous.
Thanks for that call. And Laurel, I'll let you go. I assume some other element of this story is breaking as we speak, so I'll let you go cover that now.
Always is. Thanks, Rob.
That's Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter. She joined us for a look at the latest on the legislature-sponsored investigation into the 2020 election here in Wisconsin. Coming up, a political expert joins us with some commentary on what's going on and where the investigation could lead. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this investigation led by a former state Supreme Court justice appointed by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss? Is there a question you think needs to be answered? Are you worried that this is a waste of time? Do you have questions about what's going on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the 2020 election investigation in Wisconsin being led by former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman. Subpoenas issued, then some of them retracted quickly. David Cannon is with us, professor of American politics at UW-Madison. He researches elections and election administration, among other things. You can join in with your thoughts or questions on more investigations of last year's election at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more go into this investigation, or do you think it's time to be done? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David, thanks a lot for joining us again. David, do we have you?
Sorry.
There we go.
Yeah, I am here.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Good to have you. So what are your thoughts on the investigation as it's gone so far and the twists and turns we were just talking about this week?
Well, one thing I think is an important point to start with, and that is that I think listeners need to be reminded that this election had the highest turnout in 100 years. We had more people voting in this election than any election in a century, and this was done during a pandemic. So I think we need to remember what an unusual election this was, and the fact that we had more than twice as many people voting by mail in most states. So a new mode of voting that election clerks had to deal with. And despite all of that, this was seen by experts to be the most secure election we ever had. So that's the kind of the background starting point for even talking about something like an investigation of this unusual election. And so in terms of how this has gone so far, I think it got off on really the wrong foot, which is, pretty clearly partisan intent that was aimed at looking at these conspiracy theories as the basis for trying to figure out what was going on in this election, which is exactly the wrong starting point, I think, if you want to really improve the conduct of elections, which one would hope is the purpose of an investigation like this. Because if the intent is to try to figure out how to have the better administration election during a pandemic, that is something, it's a lesson we could learn, I think, but it doesn't appear to be the focus so far.
Right. And we had heard from former Justice Gableman soon after the election claiming that it had been stolen without citing evidence. We don't know who all is on the investigation, but at least one name is a former White House lawyer during the Trump administration who had also claimed that the election was stolen prior to being involved with this investigation. Does that create some doubt about, the intent and the outcome of the investigation?
Well, absolutely. I think there's really no pretense of having this be an objective investigation. That the fact that, as Laurel mentioned, he went to Arizona to look at how they were doing that audit that was, roundly criticized by both parties as just being, not conducted in a reasonable manner. And then, going to South Dakota and meeting with MyPillow, Mike Lindell, who's chief conspiracy theorist when it comes to election administration. So this, if you're trying to establish the credibility of an investigation, that's not the way you go about it. And so I think that, almost from the beginning, this didn't seem like this was going to be anything like an objective investigation.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hello.
Good afternoon. I guess, first of all, it seems like somebody's not going to be happy until he gets his own way. And the second thing, who's paying for all of this? Are we the taxpayers paying for it? Because if we are, they're wasting my money and everybody else's money. I've never seen somebody throw such a temper tantrum because they didn't get their own way. I mean, that's what this comes down to.
Pat.
Well, right. So it's an important point, that Pat makes there in terms of the price tag of this. It's about $680,000 of taxpayers' money. And this comes on the, after we had the official recount of the election that the Trump campaign for. They spent $3 million to do the official recount of Dane County and Milwaukee County. They chose to focus on those two Democratic counties. And after that $3 million, Joe Biden had 87 more votes out of, you know, 3 million votes cast. It was that accurate. Well, that was statewide. So those two cities, it would be, you know, for Dane and Milwaukee, it was, you know, a lot less than that. But still, 87 votes more for Joe Biden after that $3 million was spent. But on the Gableman investigation, it's $680,000 of taxpayers' money.
Thanks for that call. One case that's been made by supporters of investigations here in Wisconsin and elsewhere is, you know, well, if nothing's wrong, great. We don't find anything in the investigation. If we do find problems in the way we run elections, great. We can improve them in the future. So we don't really lose anything. This is important enough to be worth this kind of investment. What do you say to that, David?
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, I think that there are some legitimate things that we could look into and learn from an investigation of this unusual election that we had in 2020 in terms of, you know, running it during a pandemic. And I think there are some legitimate questions that can be raised about things like the $10 million that came from the Zuckerberg organization, the Center for Tech and Civic Life, where they gave grants to 200 different Wisconsin communities to help them run the election. Now, that's something that, you know, I think it's reasonable to try to figure out how that money was spent. That is a valid thing to investigate. Another thing I know that some Republican state legislators are concerned about were the varying rules from city to city, from county to county, on how the absentee ballots were being treated, with the whether or not they required a witness signature or not, based on someone being indefinitely confined. And some counties, some municipalities were more generous in defining indefinitely confined, if someone was worried about getting COVID and didn't want to have a witness, you know, sign their ballot. And so, you know, thinking about things like that and maybe having, you know, some standard for the next time we have an election in a pandemic would be good to do. So, yes, I think there are some legitimate things to look at in terms of improving the conduct of elections.
When we see these, like the audit, as some people have called it in Arizona, raising questions, procedural questions about the way a locality ran the election, as you were just talking about, the idea isn't, oh, we can fix that in the future. I think the suggestion is, therefore, we should throw out ballots cast in the ways that didn't meet standards in other communities. Is that something you're getting the impression that people are saying, because of these procedural differences we have, we should not count that set, or should not have counted that set of ballots?
No, most people don't make that claim. And that claim has been rejected in dozens of federal courts. Mm-hmm. And so that's not something that's going to happen. In fact, Gableman himself said that the purpose of this investigation is not to overturn the result of the 2020 election. So that is not something that they're asking for or thinking, you know, should be the result of their investigation.
Talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison, looking at the ongoing investigation of the Wisconsin election in 2020. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Joan is with us in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. The reason that this whole investigation into Wisconsin election of 2020, the presidential election, is because Ron Voss is trying to appease Trump. Or cozy up to him, that's the nicest way I can say it, to Trump, because Trump had made some mention of Robin Voss covering up something in the Wisconsin election. That's the presidential election in 2020. Well, what happened is that a lot of Wisconsin voters voted, and they have no evidence coming forward as to why they want to investigate. We as Wisconsin taxpayers get to pay about $700,000 because Trump didn't get his way. And so he pushed on Robin Voss. And your previous caller had indicated someone didn't get their way, and so now they're throwing a fit or whatever.
Joan, thanks for the call. David, how important do you see pressure from former President Trump in inspiring these kind of investigations?
Well, it clearly is something, again, this isn't just Wisconsin. This is happening in several other states around the country as well. And so, and Trump has been pretty persistent in pressuring state officials. We also just had that Senate report released a couple of days ago about the pressure on the Justice Department that was happening. There was more evidence that came out there about what's happening in Georgia, you know, in January, and the last minute pressure on Mike Pence. And so, yeah, President Trump has been pretty single-minded in his focus on trying to keep attention on the 2020 election and his claim that he was, robbed of the election. But again, every investigation so far has shown that there is just no basis for those claims.
Thanks, Joan. We'll be talking about that Senate report on the show on Monday. In our last minute, David, do you worry about the impact of these investigations on the electoral system in the country?
I do. I mean, the thing that I most worry about is that it will undermine confidence in our elections, where, again, that's why I wanted to start with that point that I made about how this was the highest turnout election in 100 years with the most secure election that we've ever had. And we need to be collectively patting on the back our election officials who pulled that off. And so anything that sort of undermines confidence in that sort of amazing feat that happened is really unfortunate. And I hope that that isn't the result of this investigation.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, professor of American politics at UW-Madison. Earlier, we talked to WPR State Capitol Laurel White. We talked with both of them about the developing story around the investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin, led by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman. News has been breaking on that story all through the week. You can follow Laurel's reporting over at WPR.org. New story up as of about an hour ago on all of this. Coming up, the FDA is meeting this month to talk about approving Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for kids aged 5 to 11. We'll get an update on that process, plus booster shots and case numbers here in Wisconsin with one of the creators of the Dear Pandemic website, and as always, answers to some of your questions along the way. Remember, you can follow all these conversations here on the Ideas Network online at WPR.org. You can stream the Ideas Network live or go back through our archives. Or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app onto your smartphone and take us with you wherever you go. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The Food and Drug Administration is meeting later this month to consider emergency use authorization for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children 5 to 11 years old. The FDA is also looking at the issue of booster shots for the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, when they might be needed, and if mixing and matching brands would be effective. This all comes as new case numbers are trending down somewhat nationwide, but ticking up here in Wisconsin, in part because of the more contagious Delta variant. We're catching up now on the latest news with an epidemiology professor, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the need for COVID-19 booster shots for some people, third shots for some people? Not exactly the same thing, as I understand it. Have you had or scheduled a booster shot yourself? Are you wondering about kids and what the Delta variant has meant for younger people? If the vaccine is approved for children aged 5 to 11, do you have kids you would consider getting vaccinated, rush to get vaccinated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Zilber School of Public Health and a founding member of Dear Pandemic, a website and social media campaign where you can find info on COVID-19. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Well, as I mentioned, we're seeing nationwide numbers going down after peaking. Still not great, but going in the downward direction. Inching up here, it seems like, in Wisconsin. What kind of things are you watching?
Yeah, I mean, since about 4th of July, we've had a steady increase in cases. The 7-day average is hovering around 25 to 2,600 new cases per day, and about 15 deaths per day. And that's about where we were at this time last year. But this time last year, there were no vaccines. And so, and kids weren't in school. And so I think you know, I'm watching as we head into fall whether we're going to continue to see an increase in cases. And I, of course, encourage people to go get vaccinated against COVID-19 so that we don't continue to have cases and hospitalizations happening here.
Right. And we're going to get into, you know, booster shots and things like that in a bit. It still seems like the key difference is not vaccinated at all versus being vaccinated to the normal full extent, right? That's one of our key ways
Absolutely.
To prevent this.
The Wisconsin Department of Health Services reports that in the last month, the age-adjusted rate of COVID cases is 4 times higher, hospitalizations 9 times higher, and COVID deaths 11 times higher among those that are unvaccinated versus those that are fully vaccinated. So no question, your best bet is still to get vaccinated.
Now let's start talking boosters. First of all, the Pfizer vaccine approved for a booster shot for some people. Can you remind us who and when can get that booster shot?
Absolutely. So there's been two things. So back in August, there was a third dose that was approved for mRNA vaccine. So both the Pfizer and Moderna, this was authorized for immune compromised people back in August. And this is a third dose. And this is in contrast to what we consider a booster, because a third dose in this population is really necessary to even mount that initial immune response that we want to see that can protect people from SARS-CoV-2. And so that's for people who maybe are undergoing cancer treatment or have recently had an organ transplant. And so anybody in that category can get a third dose of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. More recently, Pfizer received approval from the FDA for certain subgroups of the population to get what we call a booster dose. And this is more designed that if people are experiencing waning immunity, this will kind of give them that little bolus of increase in antibody levels and hopefully prolong, you know, their protection against COVID-19. So the groups that were approved for a booster of the Pfizer vaccine, this is if it's been at least 6 months since your second dose. It's recommended that you should get this booster if you're 65 or older and are living in a long-term care setting, or if you're 50 to 64 and you have certain medical conditions. And so the Wisconsin Department of Health Services has a long list, you know, and if you go to their website or you go to their Facebook page, you can get the full list. But some of those conditions are cancer, kidney disease, diabetes, Down syndrome. So there's a long list. And then the recommendation is that those that may get a booster are those that are 18 to 49 with those similar conditions, or people that are 18 to 64 years old that are at increased risk of getting exposed to COVID or transmitting COVID. So such as people who are first responders, educators, food and agricultural workers, teachers, you know, postal service workers, grocery store workers. So basically anyone who might be at higher risk of getting exposed to COVID-19. So for that first group that are 65 and older, or are 18 and older, living in long-term care, or have 50 to 64 and have certain medical conditions, the concern there is that if those individuals do experience waned immunity post, you know, 6 to 8 months from getting their second dose, that they're at increased risk of complications from COVID-19. And so we want to make sure that those individuals are protected. And the other group, it's a combination sort of those that are younger but have certain medical conditions, or those that are just likely to be exposed and or to expose others that are at high risk of COVID-19. And so it's sort of a dual purpose recommendation there.
So that's Pfizer. Is this in the works for Moderna and or Johnson & Johnson?
Yes. So the FDA is going to meet on October 14th and 15th to discuss the same thing, booster doses of the same formulation of the original vaccine for both Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. So we hopefully have, you know, more information and or approval and answers for people who are recipients of those vaccines, whether they need to also get are recommended to get a booster soon.
Talking to Amanda Simonek, UW-Milwaukee epidemiologist and founding member of Dear Pandemic, looking at some of the latest COVID-19 and vaccine news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I got two questions. I was wondering, what about, like, I got a niece that's four. She's started 4K and a well, anyway, 4K, and what about that group? You know, I know you said 5 to 11 or whatever, they're working on it, but what about the four-year-olds? Plus, also, how do we get people that are vaccine hesitant or anti-vaxxers at all to get this, to get them? Because I knew a guy that had, that was no mask, no vaccine, didn't want to get it. He got the sickness and he died, and that's what he died from. No other underlying issues. And he, you know, and it cost him his life. So how do we get those kind of people to get their vaccines in the first place?
Samantha, wow, a lot to go after there. Amanda, first of all, vaccines for kids. Before we get to four, let's talk 5 to 11.
Yeah.
What's going on?
So on October 26th, the FDA is also going to review trial data from Pfizer for the vaccine that's been tested in kids who are ages 5 to 11. So this was a trial that was conducted among about little over 2,000 kids. And the focus here was to really identify the optimal dose that would generate the same type of immune response that we saw in adults. And what they've landed on is probably a 10 microgram dose, which is about a third of the dose given to those that are 12 and older who received the Pfizer vaccine. The FDA is going to review this data and make sure, check all the bells and whistles for safety and that the side effects are tolerable and, you know, that is all looking good so far. So hopefully FDA will approve that. I just heard that then about a week later is when the CDC Advisory Council on Immunization Practices will meet November 2nd and 3rd. And so there might be about a week after the FDA meeting where ACIP will meet and they'll discuss it. And what they do is sort of put their stamp of approval on it. And then states will open up their age eligibility. So it could happen, you know, within maybe a week or so of that FDA meeting, which is great news.
So that could be soon for 5 to 11.
Yeah.
How about Samantha's 4-year-old niece? I imagine that would be longer in coming.
There's also, you know, Pfizer as well as other companies are already conducting trials in kids who are 6 months to 4 years. So we anticipate that data will become available later this year. And then potentially the FDA would review it and meet about that early next year. So unfortunately, those kids have a little bit of time to wait. But again, it's, you know, we want this process to play out because we want the right dosage for kids whose immune systems are more robust and sort of make a stronger response to the vaccine. We want them to get the right dosage that maximizes the safety for them and generates the immune response needed to protect them.
Samantha, thanks for the call. We're talking to Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee and founding member of the website Dear Pandemic, looking at the latest news on COVID-19 vaccines. Still time for your questions at 800-642-1234 about vaccines for kids, booster shots, third shots, you name it, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Amanda Simonek, professor of epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee, about COVID-19 vaccines, booster shots, and where we stand during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Amanda, named Daryl, who wondered about the side effects of vaccines. He's hearing and seeing some things on TV that are making him worried. What would you say about side effects of the vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, side effects can vary, right? So typical side effects might be some redness or pain at the site of the injection in your arm. It may be headache, fever. Kind of this is means your immune system is working. It's reacting to the vaccine and it's doing, you know, its part to sort of build those antibodies and build up the protection against the virus should you encounter it. It ranges, right? So some people don't have any side effects. That doesn't mean the vaccine's not working. Other people may, you know, not feel great for a few days. What we've heard about the booster is that the side effects from receiving the booster seem to be similar to what is experienced after the second dose. Certainly, you know, these are temporary side effects and are still sort of a worthwhile trade-off compared to getting COVID-19.
We heard earlier from our caller, Samantha, who's concerned about how we get more people to get vaccinated. And it seems from what I've heard, Amanda, there are a lot of different reasons. Some people are anti-vaccine. Some people are hesitant. Some people want to get it, but it's not accessible for them for one reason or another in their lives. What are your thoughts on what needs to happen to boost our vaccination rates?
I mean, I encourage people who themselves have been vaccinated to have, friendly, congenial conversations with others that are still wondering, still have questions. It's okay to have questions about these vaccines. We at Dear Pandemic, the team of female PhD-trained scientists, epidemiologists, nurses, health policy experts, we've been answering questions. I think now we're probably close to 400 posts about vaccines. So if you go to our dearpandemic.org website, you can search by keyword, you can search just all of the things we posted on vaccines. What we do is at that website, you can submit your questions and we take anybody's questions and answer them. I just really encourage people to keep seeking information, to find someone they trust, whether that's their medical provider or our team at Dear Pandemic, and keep asking those questions, because I think if you can feel confident, you can feel like it's a safe vaccine, then you'll go for it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rachel is with us in Racine. Rachel, hi.
Hi, I wanted to ask for your input. I'm a healthcare worker, frontline worker, currently pregnant, 8 months pregnant. Curious about your input if I should get my booster now. They're recommending that healthcare workers get their boosters, as I had my original vaccine in December and then my secondary dose in January, or if I should just wait the month and then get the booster after the baby's born. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, pregnancy is one of the conditions that is listed for why you should get a booster. And one advantage of getting that booster now while you're still 8 months pregnant is that the antibodies that you produce can be passed to your baby across the placenta. And so any additional protection that your baby will have either that way, or if you intend to breastfeed, you could pass your antibodies against COVID-19 to your baby that way. That protection for your baby who won't be eligible to get vaccinated for some time is a great advantage to doing it now.
Thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to talk about testing, Amanda, for COVID. Just had one myself. Negative, happy to say. Department of Health Services relaunching its community testing support program. Are we doing enough testing? Do we have enough quick, easy, and available testing for people to know if they have COVID and know for sure they need to stay away from people?
I think more testing is great. If we can have access to fast, rapid tests, ideally every household would have a set of these tests at a low cost so that you could test more frequently. These tests are useful if you do them frequently because they sort of can pick up when you start to be infectious. And so adding that as a layer, whether that's, for kids that aren't vaccinated yet, or, when you're coming back from travel or going to visit grandparents, I'm in favor of adding that as one more step that you take to try to pick up on any infection before you kind of realize that you are symptomatic.
Time for one more caller. Nick is with us in La Crescent, Minnesota. Nick, hi.
Hi. My question is, in regards to the safety of the vaccines and vaccine hesitant people, if they're so safe, why have the vaccine manufacturers and the FDA and the government employers not put legal standing behind it? The manufacturers are exempt from any legal qualifications from issues or death that arise from it. The FDA is written off on that too, other than their $50,000 cap if it's long-term. With more booster shots coming out and the continuation of maybe taking 3 or 4 shots a year, with the safety being so apparent, why is nobody standing up and saying that they'll be accountable if there are issues?
Nick, thanks. Amanda, thoughts on liability on vaccines?
Well, I don't think we're at a point where we're going to be taking 3 or 4 booster shots a year. So I'd like to correct that. I can't really speak to the legal ramifications around these decisions, so I'm not going to comment on it. Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts overall on safety, Amanda, from all the vaccines that have been given so far?
Yeah, I mean, literally millions of people have now received these vaccines, and the safety profile has been great. You know, the risk of COVID-19, far more dangerous than any side effects of these vaccines. You know, what we know is that if there are going to be any side effects, they usually emerge within days to weeks. So it's not something that creeps up, you know, months and years later. And we're already well past that point and have a good sense of the safety of these vaccines.
It's a good place to leave it. Amanda, thanks again for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That's Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee and a founding member of the website Dear Pandemic. She talked with us about the latest news on COVID-19 booster shots and the possible approval of Pfizer's vaccine for younger kids that could come later this month. For the last year and a half, COVID-19 has upended study abroad programs for college students. This year, many students in Wisconsin are hoping to get their second and last chance to spend a semester in another country before graduating. But Rich Kramer reports there's still uncertainty because of the pandemic.
University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire senior Jenna Luganville is an intern in the campus's study abroad office. She manned one of dozens of tables at the school's first study abroad fair in more than a year. Luganville spent the fall of 2019 at England's Winchester University and says it was the best time of her life. That makes her excited for all of the students learning about their own options for study abroad.
I mean, it feels good to see that students are finally actually being able to go and having programs not be canceled, you know, almost instantly once students are accepted.
In March 2020, study abroad programs were halted at UW-Eau Claire and other campuses across the U.S., but things are slowly getting back to normal. In July, three students from UW-Eau Claire traveled with faculty to Central Europe for a three-week immersion trip to Germany, the Czech Republic, and Austria. Jeff DeGrave works in the study abroad office and helped organize the trip, where students learned about culture, politics, and conflicts in the region.
And within 2 weeks of us returning, the numbers had gone up, and the European Union said they would not allow non-essential travelers to Europe from the United States till further notice. So it was a window in time.
UW-Eau Claire senior Anna Green is hoping for a second chance at studying abroad before graduating next year. In March 2020, she was 3 weeks into a semester abroad in Chile when she was recalled. Now Green is scheduled to spend 2 weeks in Guatemala next spring. COVID-19 infections are now high in the Central American nation, but she prefers to be on the optimistic side and says students should go for it.
This might be your chance. You just might be able to go and have that experience you've been dreaming of. And if you just don't at least try and go for it, well, then you're not ever gonna have that possibility and that opportunity.
National surveys suggest last year's cancellations led to more than $1 billion in lost revenues for schools running study abroad programs. While programs are restarting, the COVID-19 pandemic has added a long list of hurdles to an already complex process. Melissa Torres is the president of the national nonprofit Forum on Education Abroad. She says U.S. State Department travel advisories are taking the local status of the pandemic into account, and that can change quickly.
So when you're a university trying to plan 6, 12, or 18 months out and enrolling students and having them choose their courses and lining up faculty to run some of these programs or working with overseas partners, it's really problematic.
Torrey says colleges are now using additional sources like the World Health Organization or reports from university partners abroad. She says larger colleges are likely having an easier time with it than smaller schools with less staff. Scott Pearson heads the Office of International Education at UW-Stout. He says there are usually more than 200 students abroad in a typical year. Pearson says 4 students are overseas this semester.
That was a breakthrough, a milestone for us to say, like, well, we're finally back at it. We finally have students exploring and enjoying the world again.
During a walk to the grocery store in the Belgian city of Kortrijk, UW-Stout senior Melissa Neumeier used her phone to record sounds from the neighborhood she's living in while spending a semester at Howest University. Neumeier says she was nervous about leaving home and calls mailing visa paperwork and notarized COVID-19 test results a debacle. But after a week of campus orientation and meeting fellow international students, she says it was all worth it.
Even before my classes, I've definitely opened my eyes and I've become more more confident in myself and just being able to be in a different country and further my skill set.
Schools are hopeful more students will be able to gain that kind of confidence again soon. A recent survey of universities found a majority expect to reach pre-pandemic levels of study abroad participation next year. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7, track the latest twists and turns in a Republican-led investigation of last year's election. Keeps twisting and turning this afternoon. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a former Facebook employee is accusing the company of knowingly profiting from hateful and false content. We'll talk to a Wisconsin disinformation researcher about what we're finding out about how the social media giant operates. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.